Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice, our weekly episode. I'm so excited about our conversation today, but I'll start off by saying hello to my colleague, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great.
Good, good. I'm going to let you introduce our guest today.
Yeah, we're pleased to be joined today by Harry Milman, PhD. He's the author of three best-selling nonfiction books, Forensics, The Science Behind the Deaths of Famous People, Forensics 2, The Science Behind the Deaths of Famous and Infamous People, and Forensics 3, They Got 15 Minutes of Fame from the Way They Died, as well as two award-winning mystery novels. Beyond that, as a pharmacologist, a toxicologist, and a cancer expert, Dr. Milman has testified at trials and depositions for nearly 25 years and assisted both defense and plaintiff law firms in over 350 civil, criminal, and high-profile legal cases. Harry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Can we start with your background, Harry, in terms of our listeners understanding the work of a pharmacologist? What do you do as a pharmacologist, and how has that influenced some of the legal work you've done?
Yeah, so as you indicated, I have a PhD in pharmacology. My undergrad was pharmacy, and then my master's pharmaceutics, altogether about 14 years of college. And so all these three disciplines are kind of related, but they just get more and more involved, if you will. So pharmacology specifically is the study of how drugs work in the body. And of course, that requires, when you do the degree, it requires a research project. In my case, after my master's, I had a job at the National Cancer Institute of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And by coincidence, my job was in the laboratory of toxicology, doing biochemistry, pharmacology, toxicology, research, laboratory research on anti-cancer drugs. And within about 6 months of being in the laboratory, my supervisor thought that I was PhD material. And so they sent me to a George Washington University in Washington, D.C. To do my PhD there in pharmacology. I did my coursework downtown at the university. I did my research project in the laboratory at the Cancer Institute. My boss became my advisor. The NIH paid for my schooling, and the only thing I had to do was study and put up with my boss for the next 7 years. And I thought, well, I can do that. So that's basically what happened. And my research project all dealt with toxicology, pharmacology, and biochemistry of anti-cancer drugs. And by coincidence, early on in that project, I discovered an enzyme in pancreas, a novel enzyme in pancreas, which is also found in some tumors that are resistant to certain medications. And so I was able to compare the normal enzyme with the tumor enzyme as to their biochemistry, pharmacology, and toxicology responses. It was quite an interesting project on the one hand. If you go to George Washington University and look on the shelf, at all the theses that are over there, mine happens to be the largest one, 550 pages. And the reason for that is because I did it at the Cancer Institute. My boss was my advisor, so you want to make a good impression. And so my thesis was the largest one. Now, pharmacology and toxicology are very much related. Pharmacology is, like I said, how drugs work. And toxicology is basically how drugs should not work, if you will, drugs and chemicals. That is to say, generally speaking, it's the effect of drugs and chemicals in high doses or high amounts in the body so that you get toxic effects, which can be either cancer or non-cancer effects.
Your application of this work, it seems like mostly has been in a forensic capacity. Is that right?
None of my background and work experience has been pre-planned. If you asked me back in high school, what do you want to do when you grow up? I would have said electrical engineer. You know, I was good in math and I did electrical projects on my own. But I wound up in the biological sciences. And as I mentioned, I got a job by coincidence in the laboratory. I was always interested in research, especially after I finished my master's program. So I wanted a job at the NIH, and I got a job in laboratory toxicology. If I wound up in a genetics lab, I would have been a geneticist. But I wound up in a toxicology lab, which is, turns out is exactly the kind of discipline that I wanted, although I didn't know it at the time. And so I spent 10 years at the Cancer Institute doing bench research. And then after that, I worked at the Environmental Protection Agency doing toxicology and regulatory evaluations of chemicals and drugs. And when I finished my 30-year career in the government, I didn't know what to do. I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to work for a contractor. But within 2 years, I was somebody recommended me to testify in court as a toxicology and cancer expert. I liked that experience, set up a website, and then I was picked up by attorneys for the next 23 years all over the country. Again, none of this was planned. It just kind of materialized. And then about 10 years ago, I decided to write my first mystery novel.
And Harry, if we can give our listeners a peek behind the curtain, we often talk about experts testifying at a trial, and you've just mentioned sort of serendipitously, you've been enlisted to testify at all these trials. Can you kind of give our listeners a take of when you are contacted and asked to consult and testify at a trial, how that process works on your end as an expert in toxicology and pharmacology?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I had a website, you know, with all my expertise on my resume. And let's say an attorney calls you. So we have a phone discussion initially where he tells me a little bit about the case. And it could be either a defense attorney or a plaintiff attorney. You never know. But as it turns out, I assisted in 350 cases, about half of them were defense and half of them were plaintiff. And of course, attorneys generally like that. You know, it depends on who calls you. So they call me and they tell me a little bit about the case. A lot of times, you know, just based on what they tell me, I decide they have no case. And so I tell them they have no case, and that kind of ends the conversation. They like that because now they got a response, and you know, I didn't charge them or anything, and they in turn save a lot of money because they're not going through the whole litigation process. On the other hand, sometimes you know the case is a little bit more complicated, so I certainly cannot make a determination right over the phone just based on the initial discussion. So, you know, we talk about it, and then they tell me a little bit about it, and I tell them I can help them, for example, and then they send me, depending on the case, they usually send me a lot of information. Depending on the case, could be, for example, medical records, autopsy reports, police reports, information about what happened in the case, you know, how we got to this point. And I take all that information as well, I examine all that information as well as the scientific literature, and then try to build a scientific case of what could have happened here. And then after that, you know, the process moves along, but it could end at any time. So, for example, the next step would be a deposition, for example, under oath, where you give your opinions. Basically, the whole process means that both sides are supposed to know everything what the other side knows. So when they have a deposition, the other side gets to know my opinion. I may have written a report in advance of that deposition, so they have a copy of the report, which outlines everything I have to say. And so they ask me a lot of questions. Generally, it's the other side that asks you the questions. And then after the deposition, again, they can settle the case. Basically, each side tries to monitor how strong the case is on the other side. And if one side decides that it's very strong and that their side is very weak, they might want to settle the case. But otherwise, it keeps moving along and then eventually gets to trial. And then I testify at trial under oath. So depending on when I'm contacted for the case, it could take about 2 years from the moment I get contacted to the moment the trial is held.
I noticed it says on your bio that you've testified in some really high-profile legal cases. Are you allowed to share what some of those might be that we might have heard about?
I really cannot. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's too bad. Maybe Colin can look it up.
I would say about 90% of my cases were civil, and then about 10% were criminal. But they all dealt with drugs or chemicals in one form or another. And they ran the gamut from exposure scenarios, let's say in the workplace, or food poisoning, or cancer from chemicals. It ran the gamut of all sorts of information, but it all dealt with either drugs or chemicals, and it's usually in high quantities.
Saving money on everything you need at Menards. blast. Your roof is the first line of defense against the elements, and it enhances the appearance of your home's exterior. Owens Corning shingles offer ultimate protection and impressive curb appeal. Choose from 26 colors of Owens Corning Duration shingles and transform your home today. Shop our selection of roofing products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
So your first three books are basically all about the deaths of famous people or infamous people sometimes. Is that right?
Well, not quite, but okay. To date, I've published six books. And again, like I told you, none of this was planned. So my first one was a mystery novel.
Oh, that was the first one. Okay, excuse me.
Yeah, my very first one was a mystery novel. So about, I was testifying in court all those years. And then about 10, 12 years ago, I came up with this a story. The title was A Death at Camp David. And basically, it was about the White House had a 4th of July party at Camp David. The next morning, they find the body of a woman under a tree. So what happened? Who did it? And how does it affect the election of a woman running for president of the United States? And the main character, I figured, would be a forensic toxicologist. So this way I can put my whole background experience, put into the main character. It would be very easy. Well, it wasn't that easy. It took me about 2 years, 2.5 years to finish the book. I said, thank God it's over. Too much work, too much time, too much effort. But I had my first book signing event and I sold out. People asked me, what are you writing next? And I wasn't planning on writing anything else. So at that time, the movie The Martian came out with Matt Damon. I had read the book. I saw the movie. And if you recall, for your listeners, whoever saw the movie, the main takeaway was that he grew potatoes on Mars. And that's because Andy Weir was into botany. And he wanted some botany-related issues that can occur in space that were real and factual and can actually happen. So when I saw that and I read it in the book, I said I can do the same thing with toxicology. So I came up with about 3 to 5 different toxicology-related issues that can occur in space that are real and factual. And then I built a story around it about sabotage on the International Space Station. And the book was called Soyuz, the Final Flight. And then I was hoping that it would pick up for a film, but COVID hit and the money dried up and that took care of that. But the narrator who narrated The Martian for the audiobook and won awards for that, he narrated my book as well. So at least we got that done. So now after those two books, I went to India on a vacation a couple of times and I learned a few things. And I decided to write my next mystery novel called Murder at the Taj Mahal. And I wrote about 30%. And then one day I hear on the radio that Carrie Fisher died. And for your listeners who may not remember, she had what they called a medical emergency aboard the plane as she was flying from London back to Los Angeles. And 3 days later, she died in the Los Angeles hospital. So I looked into her death. And the conclusion by the medical examiner was that she died from sleep apnea. And I didn't know that sleep apnea kills. So I decided to look further into her death. And I saw that the medical examiner came up with this conclusion, even though an autopsy was never done. And so that gave me the idea to look at other celebrity deaths. And that's how my first book came out, Forensics, the Science Behind the Deaths of Famous People. And I never finished the Taj Mahal book, although people keep asking me when I'm going to do that. So that was famous people. The second one was going to be infamous people. So I combined 18 infamous people with 18 famous people. So it's Forensics 2, the Science Behind the Deaths of Famous and Infamous People. And then the third one in that series was people who were not famous for the way they lived, but became famous for the way they died. People like George Floyd, for example, and Ron Goldman, Nicole Brown Simpson, as another example, and other interesting and unusual deaths. So that was Forensics 3. They got 15 minutes of fame from the way they died.
And then, Harry, that all takes us to your current book, which is Forensics 4, and it has the provocative title of Guilty Until Proven Innocent. And you start the book by talking about the presumption of innocence that's supposed to apply, the requirement to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, And so as you dig into what's called forensic science, what led you to choose this title of guilty until proven innocent?
Yeah, people tell me I seem to have a knack for titles, and guilty until proven innocent, because normally you think of innocent until proven guilty. But in this specific case, I was looking at people who were innocent, but were erroneously found guilty, spent 35, 45 years in prison before they were exonerated. And so it kind of gave me the idea that the justice system is topsy-turvy, if you will. It's standing on its head, because it's supposed to find the guilty people guilty. And here it is, we're finding innocent people being found guilty. And not only that, all the justice regulations and the Constitution favors the individual who's first accused. And so, for example, a quick trial, you know, is part of the Constitution. But the innocent person who's found guilty has basically little or no rights, because to get exonerated takes them forever, if at all. At the front end, you have all the accused with all the safeguards, but you don't have that at the back end for the people who are falsely accused. And so I decided to start looking at the specific individuals. And before you know it, as I'm looking and researching all the specific individuals who were innocent but found guilty, then I find that that led me into an examination of all the flaws in different types of forensic evidence. And it seems like a lot of the forensic evidence has flaws. And then I discussed that in the book.
And our listeners are pretty familiar with the revelation that a lot of the forensics that, you know, we relied on back in the day when the CSI effect kind of had us all brainwashed about how reliable certain forensic evidence is. Our listeners are pretty familiar with the fact that so much of it is flawed because many of our cases are decades old. And all these years later, we're able to go back and say, you know, this is the problem with bite mark evidence. This is the problem with hair analysis evidence, or even DNA evidence. And not all of this is related to toxicology, though. So it's like you're expanding kind of like the work that you're doing in forensic analysis. But as you're going through these different cases, and you have a lot of different cases you've done in this book, you've covered Amanda Knox, Ronald Cotton, Kirk Odom. There's a lot of different folks in here that you've covered, and how different kinds of problematic forensic evidence ended up convicting them. Of all the different kinds of forensic evidence, from like whether it's firearm, fingerprint, but what do you think is maybe the most commonly misused forensic evidence in criminal legal system?
Eyewitness identification is probably the most common. And of course, that has probably the most problems with it. About 70% of eyewitnesses get it all wrong. And I discussed that in the book. And just to expand on that, it's for many reasons, including the fact that the trial is held long after the event. So, you know, memory fades and the memory gets modified. The more you hear, the more you read, the more, you know, newspapers, you speak to people. So, you know, your memory, it gets modified and altered by circumstances. So eyewitness identification is certainly, you know, the most common, I would think. But I find that many of the evidence, I mean, evidence that we even think is infallible, like fingerprints, you know, has problems. Firearms has problems. And why is that? A lot of it is because if people are involved, and by people, I mean, scientists and analysts do the examination and conclusion on these various pieces of evidence. If people are involved, then errors can crop in. But there's a difference between mistakes and errors and outright fraud, if you will, which you also find in the judicial system among scientists and toxicologists, and whether intentional or otherwise. And I discuss that in the book.
So, for example, on the fingerprint issue, I mean, fingerprints, like you said, it seems like that should be kind of an open and shut case if you can match fingerprints. But what you're saying is it's because of the human intervention in this, like analysis. Like, you know, is that what you're talking about? Like human analysis, like people are visually examining and comparing fingerprints, doing visual examinations. That's where the error comes in.
Right. The fingerprint, the assumption is, but has never been proven, but the assumption is that everybody has a unique fingerprint. Okay. So
wait, I didn't know it's never been proven. Is that
right?
Yeah.
So the assumption is everybody has a unique fingerprint. Now, by the time of the trial, let's say, Okay, fingerprints were collected. You know, it's the first step. So fingerprints were collected. Well, a lot of times when they collect it, you know, you only have about 20% of the fingerprint, for example, or you get smudges or whatnot. So it's not necessarily a nice, clean cut, you know, complete fingerprint. All right. So that's the first problem. And then after that, you get whatever you get has to be evaluated by fingerprint experts. And you find that even experts make mistakes. You know, I'm talking about well-known experts make mistakes, in part because you don't have the full fingerprint. You only have maybe 20%, maybe smudged, whatever. But then aside from that, there are no standards for how you conclude that a given fingerprint belongs to a specific individual. That is to say, there are ridges and swirls, you know, and other markings on the fingerprint, but there are no standards either between laboratories, between states, between jurisdictions as to how many matches between the unknown fingerprint and the potential suspect have to be done in order to say, yeah, conclusively, that fingerprint belongs to this suspect. So what happens is you get different results from different people. Plus you have these experts may have different qualifications and training that they make mistakes and they get it wrong. And when they get it wrong, the problem is, even though it may just be a mistake because we're all human, nevertheless, it has great consequences for the accused who's innocent.
My assumption with, especially with fingerprint matching, was that the methodology would be that everything matches and the only way to exclude a person would be if something doesn't. So they're looking for something that does not match rather than the points that match. But it sounds like you're saying there's kind of like no standard for what's acceptable here.
Right. So like I said, with fingerprints, there are, you know, there's swirls and ridges and let's say partial fingerprints. So now when an analyst comes around and he tries to match, he compares the unknown with the known fingerprint from the suspect, and then he tries to match him to say this belongs to this one. So the question is, how many of these ridges and swirls and other areas have to match with the unknown in order to say it is a match?
You know, all of them. I feel like it should be all of them.
Right. You would think all of them, but different jurisdictions have different standards. So some of them say only 12, some say 15, some say 20 have to match. So not necessarily all of them, but because sometimes you don't have all of them. You know, you only have, like I said, a partial fingerprint. So
20%, right.
So how many have to match before you call it a match? And a match is 100% matching, you know? And so you have different qualifications on the analyst side, plus different standards between jurisdictions and laboratories.
Yeah. And Harry, Rabia mentioned earlier the CSI effect. Another thing is what I would call the Dexter effect, based upon the Dexter books and the TV show where Dexter works as the bloodstain pattern analyst. And I think that show and the way they presented his job very much left the impression on potential jurors that this is hard science, that this is grounded in a scientific method. And Harry, I read through the chapters you had on bloodstain pattern analysis in the book and can kind of share with our listeners what you found in your deep dive into what these bloodstain pattern analysts do.
Yeah, so bloodstain pattern analysis is, again, the first thing is it's never been proven, scientifically proven. And then besides that, while some stains seem to indicate a specific pattern caused by a specific way, for example, a blood spatter as a result of, let's say, a gunshot versus something else, nevertheless, it's been shown that the same pattern can be caused by other means, you know, and the National Academy of Sciences, I believe, in their report indicated that, one, there's no science to the bloodstain pattern analysis because it's never been tested scientifically. And two, there's a lot of opinion and suggestion as opposed to objective analysis, bloodstain pattern analysis. And I gave a couple of cases where people were convicted based on bloodstain pattern analysis. And again, the analysis is done by individuals, what I call so-called experts. And these experts, you know, when they go on the stand, let's remember how the judicial system works. You have two sides. You have a defense and you have a plaintiff side. Practically speaking, in a lot of cases, only one side gets an expert and the other side tries to belittle their testimony. So it's not like you're going to have two experts. And that's in part because it costs money to have an expert. So you have an expert who's basically hired by one side or the other. On the one hand, he's telling the truth, okay? But on the other hand, he's also trying to support his side. So there's a conflict there between how he's going to testify. So a lot of times they overreach in their conclusions. Typically, as a juror, it's very hard to notice when there is overreaching. So, for example, an expert might not say this blood spatter was caused by this individual pointing a gun or whatever. He might say it's consistent with. Okay, so there's a difference now between consistent with and an outright, you know, conclusion that an individual caused this blood spatter or that the fingerprint is consistent with. There's a difference. But the jurors are not that aware, if you will, of this difference. So when they hear consistent with, they might assume that it's the same as matching, you know, but that's not true. It's just consistent with. But it can be consistent with something else as well. That's the difference. It's not necessarily consistent only with use of a gun, for example, for blood spatter. The bottom line is that we need to train jurors to listen more properly and be aware of the science. We need to train attorneys on both sides, judges, and of course, experts who present the information. And then in the end, this whole group of individuals will be more attuned to the requirements and the knowledge of all these forensic evidence. But the other thing is that jurors can make a more informed decision, especially looking for corroboration of any evidence. So you can't just look at one piece of evidence, let's say an eyewitness. One of my chapters dealt with a rape victim who conclusively identified the rapist and she was wrong. But in the meantime, the innocent individual was incarcerated for about 10 years, even though he was innocent.
The Ronald Cotton case that Robbie mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah, precisely. So the thing is, what you need is not only the eyewitness identification in this case, but also corroboration of her eyewitness account. And there really wasn't any corroboration in his case that he was the one. You need to look at all the evidence. You can't just look at one piece of evidence.
I mean, I think defense counsels would completely agree with you. And I think that's the kind of case they try to make. But it's very hard to overcome, even if all you have is eyewitness testimonies, especially if it's testimony of a victim themselves, to overcome that in court, even if it stands alone. And what's frustrating for us in the work that we do is that it's hard to convince prosecutors and DAs and investigators on the state side for them to say, this is not enough for us to proceed. Like before we decide to prosecute or charge this person, we need more than this. I think that's like the big challenge. I have a question for you. A lot of the different kinds of forensics that you look at and you know, explain like how this stuff can be flawed, especially because of the human analysis involved and the human interaction involved. What about in toxicology? Do you find the same kind of thing? There's toxicology, a much more clean, more precise science where you're not going to have the same flaws.
I spoke a moment ago about corroboration. So let's look at toxicology. For example, blood work. You know, you're testing blood. Your first examination would say the narcotics in the blood. So the first one is identified classes, but doesn't identify quantities. But there are also other possibilities for the same result. For example, it might say, well, the narcotics in the blood in a screening test But then you have to do a second confirmatory test to not only identify specifically which narcotic, but also the quantity. But if you only do the first test, the screening test, a lot of times they only do the screening test and then they run with the conclusions, and the conclusions are only presumptive positives for, let's say, narcotics. But, you know, they haven't identified a narcotic, they haven't identified the quantity, and in toxicology, you know, as they say, the dose makes the poison. So you need to identify how much of something specific, and then that specific narcotic, based on the scientific literature, you can tell what sort of side effects or what sort of effects that narcotic will have on that specific dose. And then recognizing, let's say that it's a very high amount, you'll say, well, that narcotic will kill you, but a different narcotic will not because of the different potency of two medications. So a lot of times you only have, when you do blood work, you only have results of the first test, the screening test, and you don't have the confirmatory test. You know, one example that I gave was, you know, we talked about blood spatter a second ago, was the testing with luminol. You know, in one case, luminol, a substance, you know, a chemical that identifies blood, for example, on, let's say in this case was towels. But again, this is like the first test, the screening test, that blood is one possibility, but it could also be different vegetables will give the same results. So the subsequent test was never done. But based on the first test, the expert said the results were consistent with blood. And when an expert says that quickly, the jurors, I'm not sure that they really understand, one, the difference between consistent with versus, you know, is blood, you know, and two, I'm not sure that they pay that close attention to that difference, you know. So they hear an expert, especially if it's a well-renowned expert, and they take him at his word, you know, it's consistent with blood. And well, it's consistent with blood, but it's also consistent with fruits and vegetables, you know. And if the second test wasn't done, you know, you're up the creek. And meantime, you know, the jury goes with it and, you know, an innocent person gets convicted. So this is another example of a toxicology issue, which basically you need corroboration. Whatever the result, you need corroboration, either in a confirmatory test on the one hand, or maybe additional information from, you know, from the case on the other.
And Harry, let me ask you on that topic of toxicology and then corroboration, which is a subject we talked about recently on the podcast. It was the arrest of Britney Spears and being charged with DUI. And of course, you have the breathalyzer and a blood draw to determine blood alcohol concentration. But then beyond that, we have all these field sobriety tests. Stand on one leg, walk in a line and turn, say the alphabet backwards. And I wonder, Harry, as a toxicologist and a pharmacologist, what is your take on the use of those field sobriety tests and the efficacy or lack thereof of those types of tests versus the hard science of the blood draw and the breathalyzer?
Yeah, so I haven't followed the Britney Spears case, just as a point there. But in general, every test has its pluses and minuses to it. So when you're talking about these sobriety tests, so for example, an older person may not be able to, you know, to stand on one leg, you know, for 30 seconds or whatever, or walk a straight line. I think John Riggins was able to get his DUI overturned when he said he was wearing cowboy boots that prevented him from walking the straight line correctly.
Football player, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Those sobriety tests by themselves, you know, are just an indication, but they're not a conclusive indication of a DUI, if you will. And then you get the breathalyzer test and blood work. Blood work would be ideal to see, you know, the blood levels. But in the case of a DUI, for example, especially where alcohol leaves the blood at a pretty rapid rate. So the question is, when was the blood drawn relative to the incident? So you run into all those kind of issues. So I think, you know, you have to kind of take all the information together. And then on top of that, combine that with your knowledge and expertise. As an expert, the baseline is more likely than not, which means basically 51% or more of the evidence has to support your conclusion. So first of all, what you hear here is that it's not 100%, because there's always room for doubt, but 51% or more of the evidence has to support your conclusion. And for me, that means in this case, let's say in the DUI case would be Does the blood work ideally show, you know, a certain level that is consistent with DUI, which basically means above 0.08, you know, in the United States? The breathalyzer tests, there are some experts who talk about the problems with that kind of a test. Personally, I haven't usually done DUI cases for a number of different reasons, but I have done alcohol cases in general. So, and then you take all that with the clinical science from the sobriety tests, and then you put it all together and see where it takes you.
I have a question, which is a little bit kind of off the subject of like very specific science, you know, like technical stuff that you've been going into. And that is, has there ever been a case that's like completely stumped you? Completely stumped you?
Well, I can't think of any because, like I said,
because you're good at what you do.
You know, well, the thing is that the attorney calls me, as I indicated early on, and they tell me a little bit about the case. For example, let's say that they tell me an individual working in a factory, he's worked for 25, 30 years, he got cancer, and he's working with chemicals, and then, you know, he has 50 chemicals that he works with in the factory, or he's exposed to over time, and now he has cancer. Surely one of those chemicals caused this cancer. Okay, so what I usually do is, in a situation like that, I look up all those 50 chemicals, and I see, so some of them may have been shown to cause cancer in animals. So we have different stratified possibilities. Some of them may have been shown to cause cancer in humans. Some of them may have not been shown in humans, but have been shown to cause cancer in animals. And when I say in animals, they're usually tested in mice and rats. So sometimes you see that they're only positive in rats, but not in mice, in males, but not females. So there are basically four groups, two sexes for mice, two sexes for rats. So it's four groups, sometimes only positive in one group. So you have these different stratified categories. But then you also have, so from my point of view, when the person says, well, they got, let's say, liver cancer, for example, and surely one of these 50 chemicals causes is liver cancer. So I look at to see, have any of the chemicals been shown to cause liver cancer in humans? And the answer is no. The next thing is, have they been shown to cause cancer in animals? And if the answer is no, but they've been shown to cause cancer in other organs of animals. So what do we know? We know that he was exposed to chemicals that cause cancer in animals, which therefore you have to assume that they also cause cancer in humans, but there's no one-to-one relationship between the target sites. So if it causes, let's say, in the liver in an animal, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cause liver in humans. So for me, to get above that 51%, I need to see that the chemical caused cancer in humans in the liver, as opposed to in animals, in some organ, you know, because you don't know where it's going to be in humans, you know. So we know he was exposed to carcinogens, but we don't know that he was exposed to a liver carcinogens in human, and therefore it's not above the 51% for me. Now, another expert might say, good enough for them, you know. There was one lawyer who told me, well, I can get an expert to say anything. Well, you know, each to his own, but that's not me. For me, I go based on the evidence and the science, you know?
Harry, I have one final question on my end, which is, again, the book is Forensics 4, Guilty Until Proven Innocent. It's all about these huge flaws with forensic science producing all sorts of wrongful convictions. You noted earlier, we need additional training and education for judges, lawyers, and juries. You also mentioned the National Academy of Sciences report. There's the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology report. And in the wake of that, some have proposed something like an FDA for forensic science, whether that be a governmental agency or something outside the government, and group of experts who are able to declare something like bite mark comparison junk science. You think that's a good idea, Harry, to have an FDA for forensic science, or should we just keep this in the courtrooms and have the judges ruling on these in individual cases?
Well, I think, the more scrutiny and the more peer review, the better in general. Right now, what we have is, the scientific peer review on papers, and then we have different work groups, National Academy of Sciences, NIH, you name it. So I'm not sure that we need more of that. And I think we need more education in terms of, let's say, workshops for lawyers and judges on the one hand, the media providing more information for the public so that if they are ever called to jury duty, they'll be more knowledgeable. I should say that on the other side of the coin is, based on my experience, is that when you are called for jury duty, if you know too much, you're not selected for the jury.
Right. Right.
Including lawyers.
Yeah. So on the one hand, I want to train the public to be more aware of what the evidence means and make sure that it's corroborated and so forth and so on. But if you're not selected, it's not going to help anything. So it's a combination of all these individuals, where they're doing their job, if you will, in order to prevent, an innocent person being found guilty. And we're making very slow strides towards that. But maybe the more important thing is that if you are found guilty and you are innocent, to speed up the process by which you're able to prove your innocence, just like you speed up the process at the front end for the accused, because once you're found guilty, that process is very slow. It's slow in general as a process. It's slow because not all evidence is useful to be exonerated. Sometimes evidence is lost or misplaced or not available, depending on the case. So I think you have to be able to somehow speed up the process for people who are innocent, or at least they say they're innocent, in order to be exonerated. Now, what we have now is just, individual organizations that try to speed that process up, but they're limited by the resources that they have. So I think that's kind of the problem.
We are one of those groups, or if you want to call it a group or organization of people who, speeding up this entire process feels like, I don't know if that's ever going to be something we're able to do. But, I will say this. The thing about flawed forensic evidence is I've never, and maybe it's just the nature of the work that we do, we only do wrongful convictions and innocence work, but I've never seen that work in favor of a defendant. You only always see that working in favor of the state, right? When you have flawed forensic evidence, that's what's used to convict folks, whether it's a wrongful conviction or not. And the real frustration is exactly what Colin spoke about, is how do you prevent it going forward, right? From flawed evidence being used in courtrooms. There's no regulatory mechanism. There's no blanket exclusion of this kind of evidence. A judge has to rule, individually. And then putting in an agency. Obama, this is something that he was interested in looking at, and then it quickly became politicized, and it just kind of the whole thing got thrown out. It was really exciting when this, this council was brought together, and I thought, okay, maybe we'll finally see some movement in this space and try to, it's taken a long time for folks to get to the point where they realize, oh, you can falsely confess, right? 20 years ago, nobody would believe that people can give false confessions. Now it's fairly acceptable, even in the legal community, that happens. I don't think that's true yet for forensics. And I almost wonder if it's a legislative fix state by state by state, where advocates have to go state by state and say, you know what? None of this evidence can be used in a courtroom unless there's corroborating evidence, as you suggested. I don't think there's a perfect fix, but for you, and you have such a breadth of experience, what would, beyond the education part of it, because again, like you said, you educate a jury, then they don't want you, right? The state's actors don't want the education. Then what do you do? How do you deal with this?
Well, again, unfortunately, it's a slow process. And when I say slow, I mean, it's going to take years, and we don't have years to fix this. Each one of these elements in the judicial system, whether it's the defense attorney, the prosecutor, the experts, judges, they're all working towards a common goal on the one hand, which is justice. But on the other hand, they all have their own personal agendas. For example, a state prosecutor, he's elected. So he wants to be elected again next time. So when I've talked in the past to attorneys, for example, what I get from them is that it's wins and losses. It's not justice. And the same thing, if they lost the case and I was the expert in that case, if they appeal, they'll get a different expert. Why are they getting an expert? Because they figured I helped them lose. You know, so it's wins and losses. And in the process, there's justice, hopefully. But it's the way you're judged and the way they are judged is wins and losses. Because state prosecutors, for example, they get elected and they're looking to get elected next time. So how are they going to get elected next time? Well, because they got so many convictions and they've got, you know, bad guys off the street. And not only that, the police have a certain amount of immunity and lawyers have absolute immunity. And so now it's much more difficult to even accuse the police or attorneys for them, for that matter, of any misdeeds. So I'm not sure that you can do everything at once, if you will, correct everything at once. But you have to start making inroads in these different areas of police misconduct, prosecutorial misconduct. There's only one prosecutor, to the best of my knowledge, who was ever convicted, and he only spent a couple of days in jail in the end. Surely there are others, you know, so it's going to be a long fight, but it has to be done.
Yeah. Harry, have you ever worked directly on an innocence case?
No, I have not.
Well, see, this is exciting because I would love to work with you on some of the cases that we currently are working on, and even cases that we've done in the past. We've covered more than, I think at this point, 30 cases, and we actively are working on a half a dozen more at this point. So thank you so much for joining us. If there's any kind of final thoughts you want to leave with.
Well, I appreciate your inviting me, and thank you about that invitation for the innocence case. I will say that, you know, I've testified in court for about 23 of the last 26 years. As I indicated, I started writing my books about 10, 12 years ago. For a long time, I did testifying and the books at the same time. But about 2-3 years ago, I stopped testifying and just concentrated on my books. So my time is kind of limited, if you will, but I appreciate the invitation. I think shows like this and others is certainly brings the topic up in front of the audience, you know, the public, so they are aware of the issues. And like I said, it's going to be a slow process, but it's going to be a slow process that teaches the public on the one hand and trains prosecutors, attorneys, defense attorneys, and judges on the other. One of the comments that I had for my forensics book was that everybody should read it, especially if you're going to be on jury duty or if you're a lawyer or a judge. So this way you can see the limitations of the justice system and the flaws of forensic evidence. So you'll be a better participant in the justice system. So again, thank you so much for the invitation. I appreciate it very much.
Dr. Harry Milman, thank you so much for joining us. If our audience wants to find out more about your books or your work or anything, do you have a website you'd like to share, or social media? Where can they find your work?
Yeah, the book is available online. So it's Forensics 4, Guilty Until Proven Innocent. It's available online on pretty much every online store, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, as well as my website, forensics4.com, forensics4.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, You can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter. From plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.